Let us pray. Gracious, merciful God, how you feed us, we hardly know. And yet we come seeking your nourishment, your food. Beyond the sacred page, come and feed us now. Amen. Today we are continuing in a series of sermons on great matters of American culture, American practice, in which millions and millions of people are stuck in painful or unjust relations, and yet where no movement of the collective will is ready to help us out of these sloughs of despond. Our theme today is the food system in America. It seems hardly to bear repeating yet again, yet let it be heard again that this, the most prosperous of all the industrialized nations, has the largest proportion of its people in poverty. The largest proportion who are hungry. How is that possible, except that our wings are broken? Unlike gun control or criminal justice, which no politician dares touch at all, some politicians have been serious at times about poverty and hunger. Yesterday on the radio, I found myself hearing the voice of President Lyndon Johnson, recorded from 1964, saying in that unmistakable Texas drawl, "We are going to declare a war on poverty." Many in this sanctuary remember those days and that sense of possibility. And yet, how tragic was the news that followed on that clip in yesterday's report? It went like this. For the first time since 1964, the proportion of Americans living at or below the poverty line will exceed 16%. One out of six of us is poor. I think about half of them are children. Poor defined by the U.S. government as a family of four having not $23,000 to the household. This news story went on to report that although malnutrition is no longer the scourge in America that it had been prior to Johnson's initiative with, say, the food stamp program and other anti-poverty measures, today, the poor and the hungry, unlike 40 and 50 years ago, they're employed and hungry and poor. No wonder two full-time minimum wage jobs barely raises a family out of poverty in this nation. The story went on. From the main food bank in Washington, D.C. this year, a record 33 million tons of food will be distributed to 700,000 people in the capital area. The manager of that food bank, distributing to many food pantries, said she's in four decades never seen anything as bad as now. It is a hunger crisis growing into the middle class. And today, while the farm bill for 2012 languishes a bit, waiting for the Congress people to come back from their break, and while it does include as its major component the food stamp support to the tune of $60 billion, and this is the largest provision of the farm bill, I think of the application of the food stamp provision on the farm bill to be lipstick on a pig. Seriously. You could have the entire food stamp appropriation outside of a farm bill and still have a farm bill. But guess what number two expenditure is? Over $30 billions to subsidize corn and wheat and soybeans and cotton, maybe some sugar. And for whom? For very, very large farms. In fact, 70% of those subsidies go to the biggest tenth of all farms, the ones with literally hundreds of thousands of acres. And what are the results? A few more statistics and we'll leave off. Two American companies control 75% of global trade in grain. Four American companies slaughter 4 out of 5 cattle in this nation. 90% of chickens are under contract to the big companies like Purdue. Monsanto, along with 4 other companies, controls, this is astounding, 75% of the world trade in seed for growing crops. 75% controlled by 5 companies. Might there be a relationship between this massive consolidation of agribusiness and levels of poverty and hunger not known for 2 generations? Might there be some connection? Let me tell you a little story. It'll seem off topic for a minute. The first car I ever owned was not strong. It was a Saab 96. Anybody remember the car? I had a small income, and I had a small family to care for, and when I would notice a small problem, a little odd movement in the gearbox, a little mystery fluid on the drive, well, I would not act. With national car health insurance, I suppose I would have taken it to the doctor, but I didn't, and maybe I wouldn't. But before long, don't you know, some very complicated breakdown would put my car in the shop for a day or two, and the mechanic would tell me over a bill I dared not look at that such and such a defect, whose symptoms I recognized, of course, had been developing for a while, and this had caused that which had made these things happen, and now an awful bill to boot. And I would see, as I gave him my payments, that I had paid no attention to the small thing, that I myself had aggravated the conditions that had caused the big thing and the big bill, and I would slap my forehead, literally, I think, sometimes, and I would say, "It's a system, man! It's a system. Remember, everything is connected to everything. Ignore the least thing at your peril in a system." Well, of course, this warning applies to all systems. And mechanical systems are infinitely simple when compared to biological systems or human systems. In human systems, when the signal of a difficulty first shows up, you know, the way a family member perhaps there's a little shift in the way she comes to the breakfast table, and you don't pay any attention. Well, the little breakdown is ultimately linked to something which will so consume all that you really care about that you would pay your life savings to right those wrongs. When you finally acknowledge them, that they were all related. And then it's too late. Money can't even do the trick. In this sermon series we're about, every single thing we consider has this system nature. And so we need to get ready to learn about and think systemically, as they say, whether the issue is immigration, we talked about a week or two ago, warfare, war on poverty, whether it's crime and punishment, you name the issue, always the issue is, oh, America, it's a system. Everything is connected to everything. Ignore the least at your peril. The urgency of the issues is whether enough people will see the system and their part in it in time. That's the urgency. Will we see enough of us in time? Now, to actually see a system in a new way, to see how we ourselves are involved in that system, this is a spiritual process. Let me show you what I mean. I'm using the word spiritual to refer to a process of opening consciousness, a process whereby the individual becomes aware of powers higher and lower, becomes aware of values higher and lower, becomes alive to the possibility of making choices between higher and lower, of making distinctions, becomes aware also of limitations in her personality and in her culture, fears that make it difficult to choose higher and lower at the right time, becomes self-aware. This is a spiritual process. The proof that it is a kind of spiritual development is there, frankly, just in looking at the reverse, at the alternative. Imagine that same young adult with the crummy car. In a jam, such a person might also become just plain miserable about money. And being miserable about money might go get drunk, might hit someone in the family, might give up on dreams, you name it. The fact is, as we've often said in this place, in the face of loss, the alternatives available to humans, I don't know about the animals, but the alternatives available to humans in the face of loss are starkly simple. They are misery or spiritual growth. There's treading water, which is called addiction, but it's misery or spiritual growth when you're facing loss seriously. And this is true not only for individuals, but for organizations, for churches. Riverside, do you know anything about that? Yes, of course. And it's true for nations. America is poised between misery or spiritual growth. That is our situation. So, we here at the Riverside Church are committed to bring alive the spiritual meaning of citizenship in a nation grown too readily dull, often sleepy, and often very miserable. We aren't going to participate in the misery, but we're going to minister with it, and we're going to bring our own spiritual consciousness, or we'll ask God to bring our consciousness up a notch or two. Now, to our stories from the Bible. According to the great legend of the temptation in the desert, when Jesus had eaten nothing at all for 40 days, well, he was famished. That's not a surprise. Then the devil came to him and tempted him to command a stone to become bread. And Jesus' response, Jesus' refusal, honestly, shows that he knows that he is part of a system. He's got that spiritual intelligence. He knows that a system is at stake here. Think of it. Suppose the power to turn stones and dust into food were to come to a human or to a multinational organization. Suppose then that the natural relationship of the human to the earth, need and hunger of which we are all composed, not alone for substances, but for one another and for God. Suppose all those relationships were suddenly broken down by the fact that somebody could make food for free at his own, at their own magical command. Suppose. The consequence of this astounding power, again, we're still playing, sort of. The consequence of this astounding power to make people able to eat for nothing, it would not devolve upon the individual alone, as if Jesus were somehow able just to have a nice meal that hungry afternoon. Oh no, there's a whole system at stake here. For if you can turn one stone into bread, why not all the stones? In fact, Matthew's gospel says, turn these stones into breads, plural. And so the natural state of humankind, which is to hunger after more, more than substances, as we said, but relationship too, and relationship to the Creator, this natural state of humankind would twist away from the earth and away from human interactions and connections, and away from God, and would turn toward the magic man, the one with all the power to make the food and to make it cheap. All the lands would be his or theirs. All the laws would be theirs. All the armies would be theirs. All of this is involved in the image of turning stones into bread, a total distortion of human reality upon the earth. It would be a system with one free man or one free set of multinational organizations who would be enslaved to their need for more power. But Jesus said, no, enough. Man, woman, does not live by bread alone. Matthew's gospel adds, Deuteronomy 8:3 in full, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. In a book called Deep Economy by Bill McKibben, I'm sure he's well known to many of you, McKibben brings facts to bear which prove something which has slipped out of our cultural memory. Something about growing food. It's this. Large farms produce food much less efficiently than do small farms. In fact, if you really wanted to increase food production, that was your sole goal, to increase the quality and the quantity of food production from the available land upon this earth, measure it how you will, weight or food value. If you wanted to get more food, you would not have any large farms, you would have small ones. Small is beautiful. When I read that from McKibben, I remembered E.F. Schumacher's book, Small is Beautiful, and his very well-defended claim there that horticulture is more efficient than agriculture. But the reason large farming and processed foods have kicked small farms and natural food out of the way is pretty simple. Small farms require people. Large farms require oil. Oil. Since World War I, McKibben points out, since World War I, it has been cheaper to use oil than to use people to grow food. Ah, it's a system. You know, when I read that, I could hardly contain my wonder for the ancient story of Jesus' temptation in the wilderness. The author of that story, the evangelist, could never have guessed how deep the word was going when he has the devil say, command these stones to become bread. Thus, the Latin for stone, you know what it is? Petros. You know this word. It's very familiar. Petrify, yeah. How about petroleum? Oh, stone oil. That's what that word means. It's stone oil. Command this stone oil to become bread. Ay, 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 we've done it. But we haven't said no. We said yes, yes. Keep it coming. Keep it coming. Let's turn all the stones into bread. Oh boy, the food business depends on oil at every single level. We fertilize the soil, we fuel the machinery, we fumigate the crops with fungicides and pesticides, and then we fly and we drive the food to far cities. Why, the average, did you know the average carrot in your mouth has traveled 1,500 miles in this country to get there? That's more than you travel in your vacation. You know, we no longer really buy food in the supermarkets, according to these numbers. Cheap though our food supply is, and it is. In fact, we spend half of our of the percentage of our total household income spent on food before World War II. And now, we're actually spending half as much as our grandparents, depending on how old you are, as our grandparents did before the Second World War. So it's a cheap food supply, but only 1/6 of the dollars spent in the supermarkets actually go to farmers. The rest of it goes to petroleum, to packaging, to middlemen, and madmen. I mean, TV show, right? Advertising. Command these stones, oil stones, to become bread. Yes, magic man, yes. Why is it that our national culture supports this land-wasting, labor-destroying, farm-banishing bargains with the devil? Why do we support these? It's really pretty obvious. I know you have the answer in your mind. It is to save money and to save time. And I know I am fully in this system. I know it from the shape and appearance of my cupboard at home. I know I'm in it. Probably most of you are in it. We want to save time and money. We work all the time, so many of us. We're tired. We want quick food. You know, our belief in America in always more, there's always more. That belief is a national myth, and it lands on both sides of the wings of the dove. All of us Americans are involved in hoping and wishing and sometimes demanding that there will come both political and economic solutions to our wants and to our neediness, to our injustices. We expect technologies to do something in the hoped-for future to reduce the pain, to solve the things so that we don't have to give up anything that we're accustomed to so far, which is just culture, right? Progress, to guard every gain, somehow distribute more to others and other nations. We just hope in a strangely ever-progressing, growing future, that the solution will come and we will not have to change. Apart from that abstract notion that I do actually have to die and leave this place with nothing someday, apart from that, we have lost any memory of saying no to the devil, to the magic man. We've lost the memory of saying, no, it's enough. I'm okay. I could even do with a little less. A human does not live by bread alone. As a people, we've lost the memory. There are individuals who are inside that life, and we need to raise them up as our teaching saints. Because, you know, there stands a teaching deep, deep, deep in our tradition that's all about saying enough on the land, in Sabbath, in my person. Deuteronomy says, when you forget a sheaf in the field, don't go back and get it. Leave it for the poor. When you beat your olive trees, don't beat them so hard that every olive falls down into your profiting pocket. They're for the poor. Leave them. When you gather your grapes, do not glean the vines. Leave them. They are for the sojourner, the alien, the widow, the orphan. Remember that you were a slave in Egypt. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this. Oh, the heart of our tradition is so clear. Come into right relationship with your Creator, and you will know how to relate to humans as well as to God and to the land. You hear this word translated a little into our own times. Do not take all you can. Do not maximize your profits. Keep the Sabbath. Not only once in a week, keep it in the land. Let the land be fallow in some ways. Shut down your stores. No more of this 7-Eleven, 24-hour stuff. Stop. Shut down. Do not strip the land of every value it can produce. As for oil, oh, imagine if they could send us a letter. They didn't know about oil. But what if they discovered by some time machine that we discovered oil? What would the letter say? It would say, do not drain the chalice of the earth. It's a system, oh man, oh woman. It's a system. Learn to leave it beneath the holy ground so that the ground may serve you forever. Do not turn all these stones to bread. That is the heart meaning of Sabbath. To live into Sabbath, which is the spirit of grace, the spirit of enough, we need not just to see this system with a speech, for example. We need to practice it. We need to experiment. That is essential to the spiritual life, is to come up with experiments, to try things out to change our habitual nature and our patterns. So we apply this possibility of new directions in freedom and consciousness, lest those deeper wired nature for saving my money and my time end up controlling everything. Some years ago, the Vice President Cheney dismissed all changes in habits with respect to the ecology of our lands, all those personal and individual habit changes as personal virtues only. And his critique was meant to say, you could never change anything fast enough to deal with the energy demands that are coming. So, though he didn't invent the phrase, he certainly would have signed on with it, drill, baby, drill. Personal virtues. I want to conclude with a few thoughts about that. You know, I found it easy to feel after Vice President Cheney's idea. It can seem awfully small to be buying organic bananas, or maybe even small to buy a hybrid vehicle in terms of the astonishing heating of the globe and other matters, but we'll stay focused on food today. Nevertheless, if we don't change our practices at the level of our actual daily choices, there's no way that the consciousness can grow in a people to turn it from misery into spiritual growth. The fact is that the daily practice is exactly where this needs to land. And I, as your preacher, will tell you that I preach to myself first. And I got changed by my sermon already before I brought it to you today. I realized that when Corbin Hill Farm's servants and helpers approached me in the spring and said, "You want to join?" I thought to myself, well, this what sounds like saving money, but it's not saving my time. And I've been changed just in the last 3 days to realize that I need the practice of buying real food and preparing real food in a real way to get me reconnected properly to my Creator, to my society, and to the land. I need that. Maybe some of you are coming alive, and of course many of you are part of this particular community-supported agriculture, the CSA, that is here, or perhaps another one. It is the way that our consciousness actually moves from one level to another is through experiments. And I'm an experiment I'm about to begin. Perhaps you'll find one for yourself. But let me leave you with a word from Wendell Berry on this subject. Once one's farm, he's thinking about farmers and the temptation to use oil and mechanization on the farm. Once one's farm and one's thoughts have been sufficiently mechanized, focus on production, what we've been calling more, focus on production becomes merely logical. Now, after mechanization, it's certainly possible for a farmer to maintain a proper, creaturely, and stewardly awareness of the lives in her keeping. However, it requires a distinct effort of the will. And this is the theme of our sermon on Sabbath, land, and enough, to raise up a desire to apply a distinct effort of the will. Now, Berry goes on, one more sentence or two. The cultural resources that can inform and sustain such an effort of will are gathered under the heading of husbandry. And now he defines it. Husbandry is the name of all the practices that sustain life by connecting us in conserving ways to our place in the world. Husbandry is the art of keeping tied all the strands in the living networks that sustain us. Friends, in a little while, we come to the communion table. We have a tiny bread and the littlest sip of the cup of blessing. Little signs that that is enough, for God will provide. Amen.